The grit triad, which is what I now call it, is this commit, learn, and launch, right? And it's aligned with owning our past, deeply engaging in the present, and then launching towards the future with that groundedness and with that engagement. And that groundedness in our past is about owning our story and connecting to purpose. That's really the foundation of grit and resilience. And it's such critical internal work. So I'm absolutely passionate about it.
Welcome to Potent, the podcast where we explore transformative ideas and practices to help you live into your unique potential and build a more potent life. I'm your host, Stephen Lawson, a whole person productivity coach and the founder of The Monk Manual. Today, I'm joined by my friend, Shannon Huffman-Polson, founder of the Grit Institute and author of The Grit Factor, published by Harvard Business Review Press. Shannon Huffman-Polson is an incredible person. As one of the first women to fly the Apache helicopter in what many consider the most male-dominated organization in the world, the U.S. Army, Shannon is no stranger at all to adversity and navigating difficulty. In today's episode, we explore the transformational power of grit and how you can build grit in your own life to live into your own deeper potential through moving towards rather than away from discomfort, change, and difficulty. This podcast is brought to you by The Monk Manual. The Monk Manual is dedicated to providing best-in-class tools for helping you build a more potent life and experience peaceful being and purposeful doing on a daily basis. If you'd like to be more intentional with your time and energy, please visit monkmanual.com. Let's dive in. So you said you do all sorts of skiing. And you always were in Alaska. That's where you grew up.
So I was born and grew up in Anchorage, Alaska. My dad was a JAG attorney with the Army and had been stationed there at the last minute instead of being sent to Vietnam. And So that was how we got there. And I was there all the way through high school.
Yeah. Well, I want to tell you, I finished your book over the past few days preparing for this.
And thank you.
I was actually really surprised at how much a book about grit specifically geared for women seemed to resonate with me. Someone who really has probably very little overlap in a lot of ways with your own life experience, right? I've never been in the military. I've never been a woman. I haven't experienced a lot of the things. And you have a really incredible story. When I was reading through it, I'm thinking, man, you're an incredible person. I want to start by saying that. But I think the thing that was really resonant for me when I was reading The Grit Factor was this idea that in some ways we all find ourselves in situations where they're less than ideal. And not only less than ideal, but maybe feel like they're systematically designed to go against our own good.
Sure.
And
yes.
What's interesting for me is it's so pervasive throughout your book. I just get a sense that you're someone who's really heavily driven by purpose, because there's a track record of not only boldness, but also just a general sense of courage, which you lay out in the book, but I do think is really linked to purpose. So I wanted to start by asking you, what is it that made you so specifically interested in grit as it applies to women? I'd love to just hear more about why that's so deeply resonant for you.
Yeah. And to start, I guess I would say I think of grit and the grit factor as not just for women, certainly for men and for women, because the lessons and the stories, while the stories come from women who are leaders in the vanguards of their fields, they've all faced this double crucible, right? This having to both perform these exceptional tasks and responsibilities, sometimes flying in combat or leading a logistics team across Iraq. Whatever those challenges might be, they were heightened and exacerbated by the sometimes difficult environment that they were working in, which sometimes rejected them entirely, sometimes was hostile to them being there. And so that's what Stanford law professor Deborah Rhodes called a double crucible. And because of that, I really believe that these are examples that anybody can learn from, because for any minority in a majority field, anybody that's really facing these incredible challenges, that double crucible really is something that forces lessons that are available to all of us. And so I really think of this as a book for all of us. At the same time, a number of years ago, a young lieutenant reached out to me and she asked if I would help to mentor her as she began the same process that I had done a number of years before, which was to go down to Fort Rucker, Alabama, and to train as a pilot, become an aviation officer and leader. And I immediately said yes. But it had been a number of years since I had served. I had left the military. I'd gone through business school. I'd done my MFA. I'd worked in the corporate world. And so I wanted to be able to scale what I offered her. And if I did that work, which was going to be substantial, then I wanted to be able to scale the people to whom that work was offered. And so that was really the genesis of what became the Grit Factor. It was several years of interviewing leaders in the vanguards of their fields. They happened to be women, they happened to be military, but they include general officers from across the services, a Coast Guard combat rescue swimmer, one of the first women Army Rangers, aviators from World War II to the present, and many, many more. And they all shared their stories and their lessons learned with such candor and generosity that it really has been an honor to bring the Grit Factor to audiences around the world.
Yeah. So you're speaking, or what you're bringing, is a lot of stories within a particular context, right? But as you were saying, it applies to a lot of people, yeah, beyond people in the military, beyond even just women. And I would even argue probably beyond even people who maybe are in a more minority group in a particular system. And I think the reason why is because it's such a common experience for individuals to feel in some way like the cards are stacked against them, right? So maybe one example of this would be someone's in a job and they feel like maybe the workplace is a little bit maybe dysfunctional, not really a meritocracy. They feel like they're doing all the right things, but yet they're still not really getting the same advantages or whatever that might be. Sometimes that even happens in relationships, right? What I love about the concepts you address in the book is that in those instances, there's this real possibility of a loss of hope or a loss of engagement, which I think are probably tied together.
Yes.
And what you're suggesting is a pathway that goes in a different direction, that in spite of all the difficulty, you can still find a path forward. Now, is that something that you feel like your parents instilled in you and that's always been there? Or is that something that you had to kind of face and take ownership on your own? What did that look like for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. My parents were a huge influence. My dad in particular really pushed me to be the best that I could be and helped me to understand that there weren't limits that were externally imposed, that those were going to be more internal limits that I was going to have to overcome. Now, both of those, of course, turned out to be true. But at the end of the day, being raised with the idea that we are meant to push through challenges, right? That others face greater challenges than we do. I learned that through service, through our church. That was very much a part of our upbringing, was going to church every Sunday, being part of the youth group. But we also would make food for people who didn't have enough food. And I remember coming home from college one Christmas, and Christmas Eve, before we went to church, we delivered food to people who had asked for help. And I remember also that we went to several places where it didn't seem like people were actually needy, you know, like they were like young adults that could have been working or something. And I asked my dad, I was like, you know, it's Christmas Eve and we're bringing food to these people and some of them look like they're fine. And he said, you know, Shannon, you never know what somebody is going through. And he said there was a time that he had brought a load of groceries to a woman who was in a very plainly, sparsely furnished apartment with several children. It was clear that she would never have asked for help except somebody probably walked out on her. And he said, you know, if there's only one person that we're able to help in that way, it's worth it. And so I think that idea of service, which exposes you then to much greater needs than I had, right? Even though, of course, our needs always seem like they're the biggest in the moment or the most profound in the moment, I think helped to put things in perspective. And when you serve, you also learn that there are actions that you can take. There's agency that you can have in addressing a problem. And I think that applies then in our own lives as well. So it's sort of a roundabout, sort of a way to answer your question. But absolutely, I think both being raised with a background in faith as well as a background in service, as well as being pushed really hard to do well and to do my best, all three of those things come together to really help to inform that perspective. And I've never thought of it in quite that way. So I appreciate the way you asked that question.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating because as I'm listening to you respond, what I'm hearing in some ways when you're describing your upbringing is that from a very early age, purpose was instilled. You almost implicitly had an orientation towards the world where it was, you know, I actually can make an impact and I actually can go and do some definite good here, even if it's just for one person. And the incredible thing about this, I've witnessed it in my own life. I've witnessed it with people that I've worked with in coaching. But I just see this across the board. A lot of times we see individuals who do incredible things. It could be a pro athlete. It could be someone in the military. It could be a business leader. And there's an idea that we can think, well, that person's just different from me. Maybe they're smarter or they just have this innate courage. But I've come to believe that I think a lot of courage is actually just an outgrowth of that purpose, right? That purpose enables us to go and move in spite of the fear, which is something that just, I think, pervades a lot of your book. I want to ask another question related to that. I'm looking as an outsider in, right? I've never been in the military. I've never done a military test. I've never had to jump out of a plane or a helicopter. I remember that was one of the things that you were talking about. And it was interesting to me because I imagine that when you're in those scenarios, it brings you into such a close encounter or facing of death. And often, a lot of us construct large aspects of our lives around avoiding death in one way or another. So when you're looking back on your time in the military and in some of the other things you've done, right, like some of the mountain climbing work, which also is fairly risky, how do you think that also informed you, right, to in a sense maybe liberate you to new levels of purpose just by having those encounters with death where you couldn't look away from it, but you had to look it in the eyes?
Yeah. And I love that we're talking and the focus of this is purpose because the grit triad, which is what I now call it, is this commit, learn, and launch, right? And it's aligned with owning our past, deeply engaging in the present, and then launching towards the future with that groundedness and with that engagement. And that groundedness in our past is about owning our story and connecting to purpose. That's really the foundation of grit and resilience. And it's such critical internal work. So I'm absolutely passionate about it. An interesting connection with the idea of how it is that we connect to that more by virtue of facing our mortality. And it certainly was true that before we deployed, for example, in the military, right, before I went to Bosnia, before I went to Korea, you go through this sort of assembly line where you're filling out your wills, your powers of attorney, you are required to purchase life insurance. So there's certainly this preparation almost, right, for your potential not to return home. And that does make you think about things differently as a young person in your early 20s than most people in their early 20s. I would say also, though, I spent time skydiving and, as you mentioned, did a lot of big mountain climbing with Denali and Kilimanjaro. And I think some of that is this deep engagement in the present that is an opportunity to be close to a real engagement with life and understanding that life is short and that it's precious and that it goes by very quickly. I mean, even as a young person, you start to realize if you see people not come home or as you experience loss in different ways that life is short and that you want to make the most of it. And you don't want to miss out on those things that you wanted to do or that would engage you in the world meaningfully. And so I think that really is more than purpose. It's about that engagement in the world, which maybe it actually is the purpose, right? And maybe that is part of the purpose is deeply engaging in loving and witnessing to this world. And so I guess in a way, probably I wouldn't have thought about it at the time, but I think those opportunities to consider mortality relative to military deployments and skydiving and mountain climbing, which by the way, all terrified me. So it wasn't that I was without fear, but probably because of that, it really did allow me to engage more fully, knowing that time is short.
Yeah, there does seem to be some sort of link between our ability to courageously engage death and courageously engage life. Almost as if when you try to stay really safe and keep everything extremely sanitary, life has a hard time of actually creeping in, right? You kind of make your world a bit smaller. And I think that from an early age, you were living in a more expansive way. I want to ask you a question because you had mentioned this idea of trying to do good or to touch maybe the core of life. I'll have a hard time explaining it exactly as you did, but in a situation where you are in, say, the army, right? And maybe at the time, there's some people who frankly don't actually think that you belong there or don't think that you belong in certain capacities. Maybe there's some sort of sexism or it's just tradition or whatever it is. But regardless, you're kind of a sign of contradiction to these people. And I think what's so interesting about that is that in a scenario like that, you have something in your own heart, in your own mind that's telling you this is the right thing to do. That I want to do good. My purpose is directing me in this direction. But other people actually look at that as potentially a bad thing, right? Sure. It's not like you have the social cue saying like, yeah, you're on the right path. You're actually having to do something that you believe is good, but other people might not.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that and about your experience with it, and if you have any advice for people who are navigating that, because I think that's also a common thing a lot of individuals experience is what to do when they know maybe there's a community standard or there's something that's just not right, and them actually doing good makes them look bad.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a really great question, especially in these times, isn't it, where we mm-hmm. are pretty polarized and really consuming different information and approaching things in very different ways without any kind of conversation or ability to connect. I think it's a really important question. The first thing I would say is that you have to have done that work in the commit phase, which is chapters 1 and 2 of The Grit Factor, of owning your story and connecting to purpose. And I even go much deeper in this in the Paths to Purpose course that we run at the Grit Institute, where we kind of blow out purpose in multiple different ways. That is that foundation of grit and resilience. It's where you come back to every time you're pushed down or you're turned away or you're rejected or not allowed in to the work that you think that you're meant to be doing, or perhaps just simply are facing that resistance. The second leg of the grit triad is this deep engagement in the present. And the first part of that is to build your team. And honestly, I've not been great at this myself. So these lessons are lessons that come from the research. It comes from the interviews. It comes not necessarily because I did it well, right? Sometimes it's because I did it poorly that you learn those lessons many times. But building your team is a really important thing. And it's what I would say is the next step in moving forward into challenges, into any kind of potential resistance, whether it's within yourself or external, where you have a team of people that is going to support that work that you're doing. And what's important in that team is that they're not all yes men, as they call them, but they're people that will really honestly challenge you, honestly push you, and help to support that work that you're doing that you know is meaningful. And that is a really difficult thing sometimes to put together, especially for those of us who work somewhat independently, but it's a really important thing. And the second part of that, I just want to put a caveat, and I don't think this applies to anyone in your audience, but I do think that it's possible to feel consumed with purpose that is harmful. And so I think we have to realize that there's not morality inherently built into purpose, right? And so what's important to always analyze is if you're really focused on doing something and you believe in the story of both your own story and the story of whatever it is that you're working on, that it meets the criteria of first do no harm. And I think that's an important thing to caveat, because there are many places that might pull people into things that do harm. And I think it's important for civil society that we make sure that anything that we do does no harm. So those are the two things I would say is build your team, which includes a team that will challenge you and ask you to really wrestle with what it is that you're focused on and maybe wrestle with your approaches and inspire you to be your best. And also make sure that whatever action you're taking, whatever path you're taking, first does no harm.
I love that you brought that up, because meaning is such a powerful driver in our lives that a lot of times when you see individuals who, quote unquote, get radicalized in one way or another,
yes,
they actually find a really profound sense of purpose, but that can have really destructive effects. And that's because we do really kind of live off of meaning. We need meaning. And if we're totally disconnected from maybe our internal compass or I think a deeper sense of meaning, we may invent it or we may just take it from someone else, and that can be damaging. So I love that you made that disclaimer that, look, just because you're feeling really inspired doesn't mean that what you're inspired around is necessarily a thing that's going to create good, because I think that is a really important point. Related to that is there's something interesting where I find a lot of people in general, I see that there's a struggle they have in really trusting oneself, right? Mm. What I mean by that is, in the scenario we were laying out earlier about maybe going against a cultural norm that we know is not really good or maybe is harming people, and we actually end up looking bad in the moment, it can be difficult for us to really trust ourselves, to really, in the face of opposition, to know deep down that something's right. I have a daughter. She is right now 5, and it's changed my perspective on some things. I grew up with 3 brothers. For high school, I went to an all-boys school. So it's changed my perspective, because I see things, right? Like when you have a child, and you start thinking about what is the world they're growing up in, and you start seeing some of these things. And I think culturally, there's some sort of layer that makes it difficult for women to trust themselves, but also the people that I've witnessed who do some of the most profound things, the most courageous things, have been able to get in touch with that deeper part of themselves where maybe a deeper truth resides. How do you think individuals can help cultivate a trust of self? How can they get to a place where they're not only able to hear what their internal compass is saying, but sure. also to be able to recognize when it's really that compass? And this is me. I don't have a way of proving this other than this is what my experience is. And it's just, I guess, fundamentally a belief I have that I do think the deepest part of us, right, if you go really to the center of us, the desires there are good. Our operating system on the most fundamental level is good. I think kids can have some selfish tendencies, but their heart is really good. So I think a lot of the things that are destructive are layers that get added afterwards. So if someone wants to connect in with that deeper part of themselves, do you have any advice on how you can do that and how you can know it's really you?
Such good questions. And I'm so glad that you brought up your daughter. I have two children. They're two boys. And I always thought I would have girls and I would raise them to be tough and tomboys, but I had boys. And you realize it's actually quite difficult to raise boys in this world. There's a lot being written about that right now, but helping them be themselves in a world that is telling them to be lots of different things. But we're all being told to be lots of different things. And I think the pervasiveness of media and the pervasiveness of these external influences has never been higher. And so it makes it very hard to connect in with who we are. There are other reasons that might have been difficult in previous times, probably more constraining social norms and things like that. But there's so much bombarding us. And so I'm really glad that you're asking this question. We're all influenced socially because we have to be, because we're a social species and we look for those norms and we look for that validation. And that's a normal thing to do. But it's also really important, as you're bringing up, to be able to see through that and to be able to connect with the person that you are. I'm a person of faith, and however you connect to something bigger than yourself, I would say connecting to something bigger than yourself, however you define that, is a really important part of this equation. Every night, my husband and I go to bed and listen to a lectio, which is there's scripture, there's reading, there's meditation, all part of that. And I think that practice of, whether it's a prayer practice or a meditation practice, helps to train your mind, not internally, right? I don't believe it's internal. I personally really push back against that. I believe it's connected to something bigger than ourselves. And that's really important, because going internal, going inside and thinking that it's all inside is potentially dangerous and limiting, and I find exhausting. So I really think it is about connecting to something greater, however you define what that might be. And that daily practice of that is something that will allow you to, again, train your mind, train your soul to something that is bigger and purer than all of the noise that's around you. So that's part of it, is a practice like that. The second thing is, I think, doing the internal work of owning your story and connecting to purpose. Again, the first part of the grit factor is this holistic approach to grit and resilience. And it's really a holistic approach to living. And what I love about our conversation and our connection, Stephen, and that I have loved Monk Manual for a long time, and I have my newest Monk Manual here, the annual planner, is this being and this doing, right? So this concept of being, which is, who am I and how am I meant to show up in this world? And so there's this external connection to something bigger than yourself. I call it God. You might call it something else. But it's also doing the work, the reflective work that I love that you encourage people to do with Monk Manual. You can do that by journaling. You can do that by morning pages, if you're familiar with that practice as well. 20 minutes of just writing kind of free form in the morning, has to be handwritten on paper. And all of those are practices that allow you to come into closer connection with who you are. I have one final practice. So those are two things. The third thing I'll bring up is that in the moment of feeling challenged or feeling this strong resistance, it's helpful, and this can also be helpful before you make a big decision, is to sit down and write about what's most important to you. Just do that without connection to anybody else. Just write down, these are the values that are important to me. This is why these things are important to me. And there's some evidence to suggest that when you do that exercise, then the decision that you make is more in line with your values. Or perhaps you can look at the decision you've already made that you're feeling the resistance against and feel that then connection back to your values and your purpose. And so I think those three things, it's all internal work. Ideally, it's internal work that acknowledges something greater and better than all of us, is the type of thing and the type of practice that, when done regularly, starts to train and, I think, strengthen your mind and your soul to be able to weather those sorts of challenges.
You just mentioned your two boys, and I was actually going to bring this up because I think it's really interesting in that you're helping individuals grow in grit, helping develop leaders, have written this book that's sourcing stories from women who have really exhibited a strong level of grit and seem to have a strong desire to help women, to empower women. And then you have these two boys, which are ultimately going to be their own little leaders, their own part of the system. And you alluded to how there's certain things that are stacked against them today.
Yes.
How have your experiences informed what you want to emphasize with your own parenting? How is grit a factor there? How is this purpose that has been consistent throughout your life and manifest in different ways? How is that playing out now as a mother?
Oh my gosh, we could spend an entire probably three podcast episodes on this, so I'll try to keep it relatively short. I remember relatively soon after my first son was born, and I was on a business trip and sitting next to a woman. I always talk to people on planes, well, almost always, and I have the most fascinating conversations. And she happened to be a child psychologist. And I remember her saying, "Don't worry about anything. The only thing you need to worry about is resilience." And I was like, wow. Okay, that's so that I remember that. And that has always been something that I return to. And it's certainly something that I hear from clients. I hear this from parents. I hear this from companies that I work with, that there is a real concern about a lack of grit and resilience. So it is something that we work on with and talk about with our kids. And I think some of the ways that we approach that are based on both my husband's and my own experiences, of course. I mean, they do sports, they do music, they do all the things. And part of grit and resilience is pushing through difficult challenges within the context of those environments. And I think there's always opportunity there. It's some of the stories that I remember from growing up are the stories that inform me now from sports and from other types of experiences similar to that. Most recently, my kids both participated in their very first chess tournament, and they're relatively new chess players, but quite interested in it. And the tournament was, you know, a little bit overwhelming for them. They'd never been to something like that. They aren't part of a chess team at a school. We're in a very small rural community. And what I loved about that, I just actually wrote a blog post on this on my newsletter, Facing the Wind at Substack, was that there's so many life lessons in this, right? They're playing game after game after game against people who have been playing for a much longer time with much greater instruction and focus than they have. And you're going to lose. You're going to lose sometimes. And you have to learn that you just get back up and you go to the next game. And I loved that my sons would tell me something like, you know, you have to go in and you just have to look like you know what you're doing. I was like, man, they are getting so much out of this one day of playing chess. Who would have guessed? But at the same time, you know, they're Nordic skiers. And so you go out to race and you may have a bad race. Your wax might not be right on your skis, or the snow conditions might be bad, or you might fall as you are at the starting line. And so all of these things you have to learn to get back up and to keep going. And I think all of those are lessons that we try to reinforce in our conversations at home as well. At the end of the day, kids, and you learn this with when you take the inevitable positive parenting classes at some point, kids want what we all want, which is belonging and significance. And that's what they teach you in positive parenting. This is not my wisdom, but positive parenting. And I think about this again and again with any kind of challenge that people might have with employees, or they might have with retention, or they might have with recruitment. It comes back to the same thing. We want belonging and we want significance. We want to be important and valued. We need that relational piece of us, that social piece of us. Kids need that from us, and they need that from their surroundings, and they look for it in different places as they get older, which is a really important thing too, to manage the environment, because that will be significant. And they want significance. They want to be able to do something important and to make a difference and to be validated for those things. And that validation will differ over their years and their ages. So most recently, and I will say I'm really proud of my kids. They really challenge me. They really challenge us. I'm sure I really challenge them as well in terms of how it is that we relate and pushing through some of that difficult stuff that happens with kids and parenting. But my son, Samuel, who's the oldest, is about to be 14. And 2 years ago, he was really impacted by reading about the war on Ukraine. And so he completely self-initiated this fundraiser where he went out to local businesses and asked them to have a night where they would devote part of their profits to World Central Kitchen, which helps to feed people in places where they're displaced all around the world. It's an amazing organization. And he'd read about World Central Kitchen in another magazine. And so he organized this restaurant night, put an ad in the paper, and then put flyers all around town, put flyers at the restaurants. And then he reached out to lots of our friends and other people in the community. And he ended up raising $10,000 for World Central Kitchen. And there's a lot of really interesting research on this that I'm starting to dig into, which is purpose in kids, because they need belonging. They need significance. A lot of what is being taught to our kids today and a lot of what we are consuming in the news is really doomsday. The world's falling apart and it's just not worth being here. And it's awful. And I talk to kids and I hear this despair, and it's absolutely an unhealthy place to be. It's important to know about our challenges in our world, but that is an unhealthy way to present the challenges. And so what I think is a better way to bring up our children is to bring them up by taking action in significant ways appropriate to their age, so that they have that sense of agency and they see the impact and they have that sense of hope. There was a recent article in The Atlantic by Jill Filipovich called The Resilience Gap. And she brings up the idea that resilience is only possible when you have hope and when you have agency. So when we can bring up our children to have hope and to have agency, then they're able to be resilient. They're able to be gritty. They're able to connect to and act on purpose, because purpose is really actionable values, right? We're acting on values that are important in a meaningful way for the betterment of the world. And so those are all, I guess, anecdotes and ways to consider both the activities that your kids do and how it is that we talk to them about the world and how it is that we work with them in the context of this world to really be actors for the greater good, which again gives them that purpose and allows them to then blossom into contributive members of society. And so all of that is absolutely the work that I do is very much informed by what I see my kids need, which is not so different from what all of us need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that story about your son. And you don't dive too deep into your own upbringing in the Grit Factor. But my sense is that you had some really positive modeling that was done. I'm sure there were things that weren't perfect as well, just like in any family. But what's beautiful is you're doing what every parent desires to do, which is you take the best aspects of how you were raised, make a few tweaks. You say, oh, maybe I don't want to do that or this or that. And you try to create something better for your kids. I think every parent wants that for their kids. What's difficult is I do think as a macro trend, resilience was embedded in the experience of growing up a bit more in previous generations. Yes. I was kind of on the cusp of the time period where you could still kind of get beat up in school, but the bullying thing was already starting to get a little bit cranked down on. And I'm not condoning bullying and or saying it's a good thing. It's just different generations, I think, were a little bit more naturally gritty, or they formed you to be a bit more gritty.
Yeah.
Whereas now it is maybe a little bit softer, or it can be. Mm. I was on a call with someone last week who's a little bit younger than me, in mid-20s, who was explaining one of the things that a lot of people in his audience face who are younger individuals is they're not really sure how to make friends. They don't really know how to go and socially interact in that way. And, and that was interesting for me to hear, because that was not really the case. And for my generation, I've actually never heard anyone say that that's like a real struggle, but I do think that's true. I know that's going to be the case for my kids too. I think it's going to be a very difficult world that they grow up in. There's a lot of things that actually are going against what's best for the human spirit, or make it more difficult to live deeply, fully, generously. So what I think might be helpful to explore from an audience perspective is that all of us, to greater or lesser degrees, maybe we can buy into the idea that we'd like to be more resilient. And if we tap into deeper levels of purpose, if we tap into deeper levels of resilience, we may even surprise ourselves at what we're capable of. And yet we may not have been blessed with a ton of experiences in life that really challenged us.
Yes.
And the idea of actually putting ourselves out there, of doing difficult things, can be hard. How can someone who maybe they're already grown, their parents aren't helping them cultivate resilience, in some ways they have to parent themselves now. How can they cultivate resilience in themselves?
Yes, it's an important thing for all of us to do and to keep doing, because it's a perishable skill, I think. But I think what's important is that we be willing to make ourselves uncomfortable and to get comfortable being uncomfortable. We made a choice with our family to move out of the city and into a rural community, in part because it's just harder. You have the icy roads and sometimes a snowplow doesn't come and you're cold. And it's just harder when you're somewhere where everything isn't set up for comfort. And when you live in the city, where most people do, then I think you have to seek that discomfort in some ways. And I'm a big fan of making sure that you spend time in nature and out of doors. It's good for your mental health. It's good for your physical health. It's good for learning how to be uncomfortable, because nature will throw you all kinds of curveballs. So we're backpackers and hikers. And if you go up in the mountains, something's going to happen. It's going to pour rain on you, or you will have forgotten something and you're going to have to figure it out. But if you aren't willing to start putting on the backpack and heading up onto the high ridges, I think you can do it in small ways too. You can put yourself out by starting to train for a 5K, or maybe it's mentoring in a capacity that makes you a little bit uncomfortable. Maybe it's doing a service project that makes you a little bit uncomfortable. Anything that you do that puts you outside of your comfort zone, physically, mentally, spiritually, and you do this with intention, and then you, of course, reflect on it and work on what growth you're seeing, what growth you're working on. That is growth and ability that you can pull into other sections of your life. And in fact, it's a great tactic if you're feeling stuck in one area, is to say, okay, maybe I'm feeling really stuck at work and I can't get that promotion. I'm not being recognized. I don't feel like I'm doing great work right now. Put your focus onto something else. Maybe say, hey, I'm going to take Taekwondo or whatever that is. I'm going to start playing piano again, and I'm really going to focus on it for the next 6 months. And you'll find that that discomfort that leads to growth in another area is something that you can, if you use this idea of purpose and intentionality, that you can pull into your work life. And the same thing goes in either direction. So anytime you can make yourself uncomfortable on purpose, it's a good thing. And it's a good thing because you train yourself, you train your body, you train your mind, you train your spirit towards that discomfort. And it's only through discomfort that we grow. We don't grow unless we are uncomfortable. And not that you want to be uncomfortable all the time, but you certainly want to make sure that you find ways to integrate that growth into your life. And there's ways to do that, whether you live in the city or the country, whether you drive on icy roads or live in San Diego. You can make that happen. But that's what I would encourage, is finding ways to be uncomfortable so that you can grow, and then doing the reflection that allows that growth really to blossom and lead to new growth.
Yeah, something that's coming together for me right now as I'm listening to you is, I think everyone can relate to a feeling of being stuck. And I think there are times where people feel like, man, everything is just flowing in every area of my life. But I would argue that it's more common to feel like they're stuck in one way or another, right?
Yes.
Whether it's at work, whether it's in a relationship, whether it's maybe financially or something.
Sure.
Where they feel like they're stuck. And I think what can happen for a lot of people when they're feeling a sense of stuckness is they naturally start feeling like, well, this must be a me problem. And they start losing confidence, and then
yes,
it makes it difficult for them to actually go and do anything. So I think your strategy of, hey, even if it's in another domain, find
yes,
ways you can go and take on something that's difficult just in that very act, even if it seems totally unrelated. You go and you
yeah,
take up karate or whatever it might be. You start realizing, like, actually, I can do hard things. And
yes,
you get a little bit of confidence, and that momentum starts spilling over, which I think is really, really smart. What's related to that, and this is just sharing a little bit of a personal anecdote, I'm a big, big fan of coaching. I'm a big fan of mentoring, as you talk about in your book. I'm a big fan of relationships. I just think that no one really becomes any sort of great in a vacuum. It just doesn't work that way. We need people,
right,
and people mirror things back to us. They help us become that which we really are. And
yes,
we can't even really get a good assessment. Going back to even your purpose comment, if you just try and work out your purpose and it's totally disconnected from other people and totally disconnected from the reality of how it impacts other people, probably not
yes,
your purpose, because purpose is usually linked to impact and how you're touching other lives. Currently, I've two coaches, and actually have other people coaching me in other areas of my life, but more specifically on the professional front, I've two coaches, and I was talking to one of them yesterday, and we were talking about this idea of how when you grow at a certain point, you can feel stuck. But the reason that you feel stuck is, in some ways, it's like you're in a box.
Yes.
And you've actually filled up that box. You've kind of outgrown that box. And the reason that you can feel stuck is because actually the framing of the box, the container you put yourself in, is not big enough. And I imagine this has happened for you many times. You go and you accomplish certain things at periods of your life, but
yep,
then it's like the next thing, even the work you're doing now,
you're
there's
right,
an audacity to going and saying, I'm going to go and put myself out there and do this thing and try
yes,
and help in this way. There's an audacity of that. But a lot of times what comes before that, I think that stuckness can be a resistance. We can lack the confidence because we feel like it's not working. But the reason it might not be working is because we're not embracing yet that our purpose might even be bigger than we can imagine.
Yes. Right? Or that yes.
Our impact can be bigger than we imagine. Can you share a little bit about that for yourself? How have you navigated growing from one phase to another and evolving into the person that we see here today?
Well, and the person that you see today
is a big question.
Yeah, it is a big question. It continues to evolve. We're never finished. I think that's something that's really important to understand is that there's not one place that we're meant to be. We're meant to continue to evolve and to grow and to contribute. And those ways will change, the ways that we do that. Our paths will change. Our purpose can even change. And I think that is a really important thing to acknowledge is that as we go through life, as we grow and mature and our lives become more nuanced and complex in beautiful ways, that our purpose may change. And that's okay. Perhaps at some very, very deep level, it ultimately is resonating with earlier purpose. But it's important to make room for those changes. I have, just to admit, not done as well on the coaching front, and although that's an aspiration for me. But I do really enjoy and make a point of connecting with people and talking with people who are either in my field or in a related field. And I learn from everybody that I talk to include you. And I really appreciate the opportunities to learn from those people. And I actively seek learning. And so I think that is part of how I think about my purpose now is that learning is part of that purpose and that learning ideally leads to growth. But if you're lucky enough to have a mentor, and I can't assign that particular role to any particular person, but I have certainly been mentored by many people, but there hasn't been one mentor at any given stage in my life. I would love it if that was the case. And I appreciate the mentorship that I have received from many, many people. But I think being open to learning and open to growth is really important. Looking for that learning, looking for that growth. And I've been in different masterminds and different groups where there is some of that for sure. But looking for those opportunities is important so that we're challenging ourselves to always look beyond ourselves. In terms of how, I mean, the path to get here has been a very windy path. I've always known that I've wanted to write. I love ideas. I love words. I love philosophy. I've always loved that. So when I started to write, and my first book is called North of Hope, and it's a very personal memoir of a family tragedy in Alaska. That was coming back to something that I had always wanted to do since I was 10 years old. So it wasn't something new. And when people say, oh, how'd you write your first book in your 30s? I said, well, I've been writing my whole life. I've been reading my whole life. This has always been the direction that I've wanted to go. The Grit Factor was something different. It was addressing a need and a way to help others in specific ways, to help all of us in specific ways, and to define what has been successful for me or for others that might help other people find that success and that meaning and that purpose and that grit. But I guess what I come around to, and I know I'm dancing around your question a little bit, there's a lady that I talked to on my podcast on The Grit Factor named Deidre Packnett, and she's the CEO of Workboard. And she was very, very thoughtful. She's such an interesting woman. And I loved the way that she put one of her questions, which was the way to think about your personal goals or your company or organizational goals, which is to ask the question, what does great look like? If there were no limits, there's no limits at all. What does great look like? What does great look like for you as a person? Who would you be if there were no constraints or limitations? And then write it out, as audacious as that might be. And for your company, the same practices will work. And in the Grit Factor, the same practices can work for an organization as work for an individual with slight modifications. So what does great look like? When I ask myself that, It continues to direct me, whether as a parent or as a writer or as a business owner. And I do executive training through the Grit Institute in both purpose and in leadership and grit. And so what does great look like? What does great look like for this program? What does great look like for me as a teacher, for me as a writer, for me as a person in this world? And asking that question, which of course has to necessarily be informed by your purpose and your values, has helped me really be able to continue to push myself and stretch myself. And I've started to realize recently that the understanding that sometimes you see something that feels like, hey, that's what great looks like, and I can do this in the next 3 months. And sometimes you're not ready for it, and that's okay. You might write it down. It might be in your goal sheet, or it might be in your ideas sheet, and it might be something that you even say, I'm going to start working on this right now. And I've done that in the past. And it's turned out that I wasn't quite ready for it. And that's all right, because I was doing other things. And then I was ready for it later. And I did the work that led to other work that led to other work. And so I think being open to that organic development, as long as you're being intentional, as long as you're connecting back to purpose, asking yourself what great looks like, and then giving yourself grace to navigate that path, knowing that at some point you will be ready, or you will realize that it's a different path that you're meant to take. But allowing that organic path to unfold is part of the process. It's not always being totally laser focused. Sometimes it is, but a lot of times it's about continuing to cultivate the energy and following that energy. We have a particular energy that is applied in the way that we're meant to go. And as long as you're intentional about your path, you can start to feel your way in that direction.
Yeah, I love when you're talking about Instagram and how there's all these self-help pathways and they get positioned to us as, all right, go buy this thing or join this group or do this thing and it's going to get you what you want. And it's actually in some ways true, but the image that was coming to mind as I was listening to you was, if you think of something like American Ninja Warrior, where there's these little podiums and you have to jump across and climb, and sure, you can watch someone do that and they make it look really easy. And right. It is true that the way it's all set up, you can get from one place to another place, but the actual implementation is where things can be really difficult. So a lot of times in the self-helpy genre, there's a lot of overselling and promises that ultimately lead us to feel bad about ourselves and fall off of confidence because it's positioned like, do this thing, you get this result, but it's kind of like an ideal scenario, you get that result. And so it ends up creating these negative experiences and maybe even negative understandings for ourselves. And what I'm hearing you say is a lot of times we might be attracted to some level of greatness and we see that as 10 miles up the road, but it also can be helpful to, I guess, two things. One is figuring out what's 1 mile up the road, but then also just being dedicated to keep going with that analogy, driving every day, keeping dedicated to staying in that groove of discomfort where you're not overwhelming yourself with discomfort, but you're also not sitting back and trusting the process that if you do that with your intentions in the right place, that you will make progress. And I think that that is evident. That is the case. And a lot of the most sustainable growth is slow growth. We love get rich quick schemes and quick, healthy, quick schemes, all those things. Most things don't work that way, though. You know, nature doesn't work that way.
And I would say not just trust the process, which is really important, but I actually was on a flight from Seattle to Boston where I had a wonderful conversation. I got on the flight and I moved to allow the woman that was in the window seat to come in to sit down at the very beginning of the flight. And we talked for the entire way across the country. And we did not stop talking until we landed. And it turns out she's on a medical ethics board. She's a PhD in philosophy. She's a nurse. Just the most fascinating conversation. And one of the things that she brought up in our conversation was that she does martial arts. And I think she probably is 65 years old. I mean, she's been working for quite a while and been doing martial arts for quite a while. But her martial arts dojo told her, you have to learn to love your push-ups. And I think the key is we have to learn to love the work, not to be wedded to the outcome, but to really love the work that is grounded in purpose. And if you can love the work that is grounded in purpose, because the outcome is going to take a tremendous amount of work that most people are not willing to do. But if you learn to love the work, well, then you're in it. You love it. You do it. You find the extra energy for it. And that's where the really great stuff happens. And again, it is about how it is that we focus our energy. We commit our energy, and that builds the energy in the work itself. And if you can do that, you've already won. You've already won whatever the outcome is. But the outcome will also be good if you learn to love the work. So love your push-ups or whatever your analogy is. Learn to love the work. I think that's a really important opportunity for all of us.
I love that line from Mary Poppins. For every job that must be done, there's an element of fun. You find the fun and snap the job's a game. I watched Mary Poppins as a kid, and it's like one of those things that got implanted in me. And I think it's not just fun, but it's fun and purpose. If you can find the life in the work. And maybe that's even tied to the concept of energy. If you can find the thing that's vital in the work, it no longer feels like something that's draining you, but it's actually filling you up. Then it's just all joy. And not that it's easy.
Right.
But it's joy. One of the things that's actually still to this day surprises me, I don't necessarily like running, but I kind of do. And what I actually like more than anything is when I'm outside running and it's like 32 degrees and it feels really hard. And my lungs are actually burning from the cold air, but I feel amazing. And I just feel like there's something that I get tapped into in it That just feels so good. And I know there's actual physical things taking place in that as well. But there's something, if you can find that groove of the discomfort paired to purpose, there's always something deeper. I think an important point on that is for most of us, there's certain things we have to do every day anyways. Some things we don't want to do. Wash the dishes, do laundry, whatever, clean up dog poop in our backyard. I don't know.
Sure.
But all those things, and this is going to sound really crazy, but it's been my experience, all those things can really turn into a joy when they're wrapped in a sense of service and when they're wrapped in a sense of personal growth. And that's scary how much you can grow when you're operating in that way.
It is. And the other piece I would add to that is gratitude. I've been trying to find for a while, there is a particular monastic practice, I believe, which is a practice of gratitude as you wash the dishes. I mean, you have dishes to wash. You have food to eat that was on those dishes. Not everybody has either of those things. And it sounds a little bit cheesy, and I think I might have laughed at this 15 years ago or so. But really, if you can think about that, or the other thing is changing your mindset in the midst of the challenges from I have to do this to I get to do this. And then it's this prompt that says, why should I be grateful for doing this? Why should I be grateful for picking up the dog poop in the yard? Well, I have a yard, I have a dog that I love, and I have the use of my limbs and my faculties. Challenge yourself to say, why should this make me grateful? And I bet you can find some things. And that science of gratitude in the reflection of our lives, whether it's hard stuff and not fun stuff, or whether it's a gift, whatever it is, challenging ourselves to really find that is a life changer. It's a complete and total revelation. And I think there's just incredible opportunity in that.
Yeah, it's not even just a game changer from a pragmatic, okay, what does this do from a utility standpoint in your life? It's a game changer insofar as it actually changes your experience of life entirely. Materially, it can be actually the exact same. It can be the same spouse. It can be the same job. It can be the same problems. But everything's also totally different at the same time because you're different. Because I actually believe the majority of our experience of life doesn't actually have to do as much with our life at all as it does with our attention and what we pay attention to in our life. If we pay attention to the good things, our life is going to appear very good. If we pay attention to the negative things, our life's going to appear very negative.
100%. Where you put your focus is what your life is about.
Yes. So let's explore, as we're winding down our time here today.
Sure.
For someone who wants to cultivate grit in their own life, for someone who maybe wants to level up in one way or another, or they want to maybe even just find hope, a way to persevere and to move forward, what would be your recommendation on just a couple of ways that they could get started or look at their current circumstance in a different way?
I mean, part of this is what we just said, which is where we put our focus. So putting our focus on those things that will help us in those places where we want to grow is the first step. So identifying that desire is, I think, the first step. One of the reasons that I developed courses at the Grit Institute is for people who want to do exactly this. So read The Grit Factor and take Going for Grit and Paths to Purpose for sure. But I think the first thing that you can do is really to say, what is a way that I'm going to challenge myself that might make me uncomfortable? What can I do even today? What can I do this week? What can I do this month? Maybe there are three different things that you're going to continue and challenge yourself to do that, whatever that thing is. And I think that's the right first step. It's making that commitment. The commitment matters, right? The follow through on that action for that commitment matters. And then you're starting to push yourself to greater and greater levels of challenge. Maybe it's challenge is a better word than discomfort. We grow through those challenges. We grow through that discomfort. And so that's one opportunity, I think, that will absolutely help. The second piece is look for a way to serve. And I say that not just because it's a good thing to serve, because it is, because it will make your life better. But also, you know, we just came back from the Army-Navy game, and I had the opportunity to be there with this group called the Costa Freedom Foundation. And they are supporting severely injured veterans from the wars of the last 20 years. And so we were there with, I bet there were 10 out of a group of 100 young men in this case who had lost sometimes both legs or one leg or an arm. And when you participate in something that allows you to see the incredible courage and strength and grit and resilience of others, we learn through those stories. And so I think part of it is owning our own story. Part of it is looking for the other stories that will inspire us and guide us and lead us. And those stories can be in books. They can be in the people that you serve at a homeless shelter. They're everywhere. So being aware and really looking for those opportunities to learn from others' experiences. And they're not always necessarily just Tony Robbins on your Instagram, right? It's the guy that's lost both legs that is making it through and doesn't have a house yet where he can live with his family. So whatever it is that you are doing to serve, allow yourself to take inspiration and to learn from those people who are going through greater challenges. I think we're all connected by love and we're all connected by suffering. And sometimes we think that we're alone in that suffering. And it's helpful to go out and serve because you see that you're not alone and you see that you can learn and grow from the stories of others. So that is why The Grit Factor is written in a narrative form so that you read the stories that can inspire you. We all need those stories and that connection to story. So I guess to sum that up is we're really looking for the opportunity to make ourselves uncomfortable and to challenge ourselves, right? Because we grow from that challenge. And then we're looking for the opportunity to serve others who are going through possibly greater challenges and take inspiration and grow from that inspiration as well.
Yeah, that resonates so deeply for me. And just to affirm, especially the inspiration point, I think I've noticed in my own life, the more I've done things that have made me uncomfortable, the more I've tried to lean into the areas that scare me a bit, inspiration just becomes really important. And it seems like it's a silly thing, but being intentional about consuming good mental, emotional, spiritual food, it's really important. And it does make a tangible difference. I want to recommend everyone, if you're interested in what we've been talking about today, The Grit Factor is really a great book. I took a lot away from it. Obviously, we covered some things here, but it was just really just scratching the surface of not only Shan's story, but also some of Shan's insights. And if you'd like to learn more about what Shan's doing and her work and potentially grow, cultivate your own grit in your life, Shan, where can they find more about what you're doing?
Sure. I'm online at shannonpolson.com as well as thegritinstitute.com. And primarily active on LinkedIn as well as a little bit on Instagram. So I'd love to see all of you there.
Shan, thank you so much. This has been wonderful.
Thank you so much, Stephen. It's really a pleasure to connect with you always. And I'm such a fan of the work that you're doing in the world. And I love the synergies between the Grit Institute and Monk Manual.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Potent. If you'd like to learn more about Shan Huffman-Polson and her work with the Grit Institute, please visit www.thegritinstitute.com. I'd like to end each episode by encouraging you, the listener, to identify something from today's episode that you'd like to change or incorporate into your life as a result of what you heard today. Don't let ideas stay ideas. Find one small action you can take, starting today, to set yourself on a path to a fuller life. If you haven't already, I invite you to subscribe to this podcast and leave us a review. This is a free way you can support this program and help us reach more individuals who are seeking to live a fuller life. You can also follow us on YouTube and Instagram. Links to both are available on our website, thepotentpod.com. And now, some inspiration for the week. Once upon a time, a young eagle found himself growing up in a chicken coop, surrounded by chicken siblings. Raised from a tender age among the clucks and pecks of his chicken companions, the eagle wholeheartedly embraced his identity as a chicken. In this coop, no one spoke to him about the majesty of eagles, and everyone treated him as one of their own. The eagle adopted a chicken-like inner dialogue, clucking and pecking with the best of them. His thoughts, habits, and dreams mirrored those of his feathered companions. As the years passed, the eagle aged, but the world of his internal dialogue remained largely unchanged. One day, while foraging for seeds alongside his chicken brethren, the eagle witnessed a magnificent sight in the sky. Creature soared high above, catching his attention. Having spent most of his life within the coop, it was the first time the eagle had seen such a majestic animal. Excitedly, the eagle turned to a nearby chicken, asking, "Do you see that? What an absolutely magnificent creature. Do you know what it is?" To this, the eagle's chicken sibling replied, "Yes, that is an eagle. He is a majestic king of the skies. You need not concern yourself with eagles. You and I are chickens and could never soar with the eagles. The sooner you get back to pecking for seeds, the better." Reluctantly, the eagle turned away from the skies, resuming his foraging. From that day on, he never encountered another of his kind. However, throughout his life, the memory of that one extraordinary eagle lingered with him, leaving him with an unshakable feeling that there must be more. Until next time, I wish you all the best. Steve.